Talking History with Patrick Gagan. This is News Talk.
We shall fight on the beaches, we shall fight in the hills, we shall never surrender.
And out of that silence came thousands of voices.
The strategy of the white man has always been divide and conquer.
It's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
Auchtereuen, Argus.
Good evening and welcome. We're talking history on News Talk 106 to 108 with me, Patrick Gagan. In tonight's show, Medea, murderous mother, magician, or a woman whose story has been distorted for more than 2,000 years. We'll also be finding out about the forgotten women who transformed science and why so many of their discoveries were credited to somebody else. And from Gutenberg to Amazon, how the humble bookshop survived six centuries of censorship, competition, and predictions of its death. You can email us your thoughts and comments to talkinghistory@newstalk.com, and we'd love to hear from you. And we begin tonight's show with Medea. A new book explores the possibility that Medea, mythology's archetypal murderous mother, could be based on an historical figure who migrated to Greece in the late Bronze Age. Medea has appeared in countless works of art, plays, operas, musicals, ballets, movies, poems, paintings, sculptures, and novels. But until now, no one has written a biography of her. Through meticulous research, the award-winning scholar Edith Hall brings new life to Medea's story, from her lonely childhood on the shores of the Baltic Sea, through a dramatic escape with Jason and the Argonauts, the murders and attempted palace coup, all the way to her final exile in Athens. And in reframing a figure long reduced to villainy, the book restores Medea's humanity, illuminating a woman pushed to extremes by betrayal and displacement. The book is called Medea, A Life. It's published in hardback by Yale University Press, and I'm delighted to be joined by the author, Edith Hall. Edith, you're very welcome to the show, and I want to begin with how you open the book, because you describe Medea as an outsider, a witch, a murderer, a manipulator, adventurous, but also as a fierce symbol of women's refusal to submit to male authority. So tell us about the character of Medea and what attracted you to writing her story.
Well, I've been fascinated since I was a little girl and watched the Jason and the Argonauts movie. But of course, she doesn't do any bad things in that. And it wasn't until I was a teenager that I discovered that she'd actually killed her own children. Now, this is the crime that people just can't stand. So she's been vilified across the centuries. But over the last sort of 150 years with the women's rights movement, people have said, well, look at the position she was put in. She was completely mistreated by her husband. She was abandoned as an immigrant in a foreign land. She was hounded by patriarchal people. She was intelligent, but nobody let her express it. You know, so there's been huge sympathy for her. And it's that contradiction that I find so fascinating.
And there's, of course, the famous work by Euripides, but also she's appeared in countless works of art, in plays and operas and ballets and movies and poems and paintings. She has inspired so many artists and writers and thinkers and playwrights throughout the centuries.
Yes, she has. And I think there's several reasons for that. One of them is just the brilliance of Euripides. I mean, nobody has ever written divorced dialogues between a warring couple like that. They send absolute shivers down the spine of anybody in the audience. It sounds so incredibly modern. But another is, it's actually the first really great murder play where we are being talked to by somebody who goes from not going to commit murder, she's just suffering, she's been abandoned, to these terrible crimes. And she tells us how she's feeling. It's very interior. It's very psychological. And just before she actually kills the kids, she says this extraordinary thing. She says, I know what I'm going to do is wrong, but my rage has overcome my ability to make decisions. Now, that is a fascinating legal and philosophical issue, right? It's what is free will? Does she have exonerating circumstances? Was she provoked? Provocation is a legal offence that you could use for her, right? That she had been appallingly insulted. So I think that it's got intellectual and philosophical depth as well as raw emotional power.
Talk to us about her name, because even her name and the way it can be translated as she thinker or she schemer, it seems that from the very beginning, this is a woman whose intelligence is seen as dangerous.
Yes, indeed. Female intelligence was much suspected in ancient Greece. The only exception to that is actually Penelope in the Odyssey, where Odysseus loves the fact that Penelope is up to him and can make plans and trick suitors and so on. Everywhere else, it's highly suspect. It's compounded in Medea's case because she's not Greek. There is a huge race issue going on. She's from what is now the Republic of Georgia. It was called Colchis. It's a far, far corner for the Greeks of the Eastern Black Sea. And she's got all these skills in witchcraft. She's an unknown quantity in terms of her supernatural powers as well as her natural intelligence. So I think she must have struck terror into the heart of every ancient Greek in the audience.
Tell us about her relationship with Jason then, and how much she sacrifices for Jason, even including being involved in the murder of her own brother. And that leads to an irrevocable break with her family, with her homeland, and sets her on a completely different course.
Yes. Well, she puts, as we say in England, I'm sure you've heard it in Ireland, she puts all her eggs in one basket. She throws everything in with Jason. I learned from the sources that she must have had a very miserable childhood. Her father was a very cruel patriarch who didn't like his daughters. He only liked his son. And she is desperate to get out of this country. So she just decides to throw everything in with Jason and escape with him. When her brother is sent after to get them back, get her back for punishment for helping steal the golden fleece, she had no choice. It was her or him. If he took her back, she faced certain death. So I have some sympathy with, you know, if it really is you or your horrible brother. So that's the first murder she does. But this means that she has absolutely nowhere to go if Jason leaves her. She has absolutely no other possibility of survival. And that's where I start to become extremely sympathetic with the way that she had recourse to very amoral means for her own and her children's survival.
And when we're talking about Medea, are we talking about a mythological figure, or are we talking about perhaps a real historical figure who was then mythologized?
That's a very good question, and it lay at the heart of the sort of problem. Yale University Press asked me to write a biography of Medea. And at first I said, what do you mean? She's a mythical character. But then I discovered an ancient Greek, very brilliant, a Black Sea Greek called Strabo, said Medea was definitely a historical person. There were Greek men who went to the Black Sea, this is all true, and colonized it, including the whole eastern corner, did trade with it, and they brought back wives from that area. They absolutely did. So I thought, okay, this particular woman may not have existed, but wives who left their beloved homelands or the places they'd been brought up all around the Black Sea and had to go and cope in Greek city-states facing all kinds of prejudices and husbands who might leave them if a better opportunity turned up, as it did for Jason when he's offered the hand of the princess of Corinth. She is a real type of person, even if she's not real.
So what goes wrong with Jason then? They're together for many years, they have children, and then he cruelly abandons her. What goes wrong in that relationship?
Well, they end up in Corinth, which is actually where her father originally came from. He emigrated to the Black Sea, and she's actually held in high esteem. She uses her magic positively. She helps solve droughts. She's very popular, and he becomes, guess what, very envious of her success. And he decides that he's going to do the best he can for himself. He hears that the Corinthian king has no sons, but he has got a marriageable daughter. And so he basically says, I'm not really married to that woman. We never had a proper wedding, which is true. And he accepts the hand of the princess, which means he will become king of Corinth. And he doesn't mind that his father-in-law says Medea's got to go into exile. She's too dangerous. He doesn't even try to protect his wife of 10 years and their relationship. That's where Euripides' play comes in. At that exact point, she has just been abandoned. She has just discovered that her beloved Jason is actually marrying is probably already married this other girl, and who's much younger and, you know, very rich. And that is the crisis. And that's why people feel so sympathetic to her, because when the play opens, he is entirely in the wrong. And Euripides stages, and this is in chapter four, my modern take on that play, the dialogue there. He says things to her like, you're just a barbarian, as racial abuse. He says, you're sex-starved, you're sex-mad, you only want me for sex. You know, you're completely off the wall, it's all your fault. And then the killer line, he said, I did it for you, darling. Let's all have one big, happy, blended family. I was thinking of you.
But what about the children there? And that's the act that's defined Medea for thousands of years. And in your book, you really do balance the different things. You reconstruct the psychological path towards the crime without asking the reader to forgive it. But it is very complex, because many women have sadly throughout history been betrayed by men, abandoned by men, abused and mistreated. But yet they don't cross that line and do something so horrific and unimaginable. No. So how do we explain? How do we try to understand that?
Well, I did a lot of research into forensic psychology. I have read big research articles on the pathology of what's technically called maternal filicide. It's not infanticide. That means killing any child. Filicide is killing your own. And there is a very distinct profile that emerges. And it's uncanny how Euripides has got it. These are women, very often immigrants, who have no responsible adults left to support them. At the very precise moment of crisis, you know, they have no family. They're all alone in a strange land. They're absolutely desperate. And they're often very clever and well-educated. They also always have form. They have had a hot temper before, right? That is the profile. This fits Medea precisely. This is the point at which I lose sympathy with her, obviously. But I lean very heavily on the suggestions in the ancient sources that she thinks she's carrying out the will of Zeus, who punishes people who break their oaths, that she actually thinks that she's the granddaughter of Helios, the sun god. She stops being a human mortal thing. I think she's got a fantasy, right? She's sort of got a bit psychotic. She's got a fantasy that she is carrying out divine retribution. She doesn't understand why Zeus hasn't punished Jason. She wants the maximum punishment for him and forgets the children. They become collateral victims.
And her story and the tragedy inherent in it has been marshalled for various very, very good causes in terms of women's rights and suffrage and trying to counteract a lot of that patriarchy and misogyny in society.
Yes, it's really remarkable. She has completely inspired women, not just in terms of campaigning for women's rights. You know, she was used by the suffragettes. She's been used to campaign for women's education. She's been used for injustice for women under the law, precisely over things like provocation. And she's inspired female creative artists, right? This is one of the best roles, female roles ever written, because of the emotional and psychological vicissitudes. And your own writers, Marina Carr, by The Bog of Cats, is one of the very best adaptations of Medea I have ever seen. Her play really gets into the soul of this woman who is facing class issues and sort of racial issues as well. I think Marina Carr got the darkness and the predicament better than almost any other writer. I think it's very Irish in a way.
Okay, well, my thanks to Edith Hall for joining us tonight to talk about her wonderful new book, Medea, A Life. It's published in hardback by Yale University Press. Thank you so much, Edith, and we'll be back with more Talking History on News Talk right after this. Welcome back, we're Talking History. Women have always been part of the story of science, even when history has failed to remember their names. From pioneering researchers who challenged accepted ideas to women whose discoveries were overlooked or credited to others, their experiences reveal how science itself has changed. And a brilliant new book brings these remarkable figures back into view, exploring the obstacles they encountered, the discoveries they made, and the worlds in which they worked. It also asks why some scientific lives are celebrated while others disappear from the record. The book is called A History of Science in 21 Women. It's published in hardback by One World Publications. The author is Marika Big. And Marika, you're very welcome to the show. And can we begin, I suppose, with that famous phrase about standing on the shoulders of giants? Because one of the points you make at the start is that we sometimes get this wrong because the idea of who those giants were is profoundly distorted.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. And also, I would add that a lot of women in the past and currently don't have access to those networks of giants who are all referencing each other in their papers and building on each other's findings. They're not part of that conversation.
So why do you think, is it down to misogyny? Is it the patriarchy? Why have so many brilliant women, and you explore the lives of 21 here who have made such significant contributions, going back thousands of years to 4th and 5th century Alexandria, why have they been excluded and denied that recognition for so long?
Yeah, I think a lot of that is patriarchy in the sense that women have been denied education. A lot of women weren't getting access to scientific education in the way men were, up to very recently, in fact. And then you get this sort of self-perpetuating cycle where women also aren't seeing other women in those kinds of positions. Women aren't winning the Nobel Prize as much as men are. So young girls aren't encouraged to enter into these fields that are very male-dominated, might not feel comfortable or included in those spaces. So it's a sort of reinforcing situation that's been going on way too long.
So let's begin back in Alexandria in the 4th and 5th century. How did a woman become one of the most respected mathematicians and philosophers of the ancient world?
Yeah, so Hypatia, she was definitely not from a poor background. So she was born into a very middle-class family, which meant that she did get educated the way that boys did. Her father was also the head of a school in Alexandria. So he taught maths and philosophy, and she received the same education many of his students did. So she had a pretty unusual start, in a sense, although there were other women of her class who were educated. It was a really small pool of them. And then she went on to, I guess, and again, we don't have many records of this time, so it's very difficult to get a sense of exactly what she was like. But she must have been quite assertive, quite single-minded, because she kind of had the guts to challenge her father on a lot of his ideas. There was a kind of hierarchy where maths was at the top at the time, above philosophy, and she said, "No, philosophy is the most important." So she challenged her father. She worked with him as well, edited a lot of texts, famous mathematical texts of the era. And by really proposing this kind of philosophy as really central, she managed to also unite a lot of disparate groups of people, scholars at the time. So for a bit of context, Alexandria was very, there was a lot of religious strife in the city between pagans and Christians. And because she kind of posited this philosophy above all else, she was able to unite those groups within her school and become this very influential teacher who brought together scholars from lots of different backgrounds.
So there are so many famous names in it, people like Ada Lovelace, who we'll be familiar with, but there are also some astonishing recoveries in the book. For example, the story of Eunice Foote and her discoveries when it comes to experiments with gases and carbon dioxide and things that we would now associate as being so crucial to the climate movement.
Yeah, it's an incredible story, you know, about an American scientist and an inventor who was working, you know, in the sort of mid-1800s from a home laboratory, who conducted an experiment that provided kind of a rudimentary evidence for the what we today call the greenhouse effect. And her discoveries, they were documented, but not really included in the most influential scientific kind of journals of the time. And the credit for that discovery went to a British scientist, a man. And her findings were only rediscovered very recently in 2011, I think, by an amateur historian who happened to be flicking through one of these kind of catalogues of scientific findings for the year 1856, and landed on an account of her work. So she was completely ignored for a really long time.
Can we talk about the scientist who should have won the Nobel Prize, but instead it went to two male theoreticians? She overturns one of the fundamental assumptions of physics, that nature obeyed parity.
Yes, exactly. So Hsien-Hsun Wu was a Chinese-American experimental physicist, and she took on an experiment that no other physicists at the time dared take on, that challenged one of the fundamental laws of physics, that which was the principle of parity. So that basically the universe doesn't distinguish between right and left. If a reaction happens on one side, it will be mirrored exactly on the other side. And she conducted a really complicated experiment that that proved that for weak interactions, these do not behave symmetrically when reflected kind of in a mirror. So she overturned a really fundamental assumption in physics, and it won two of her male counterparts the Nobel Prize, but she wasn't recognized.
Dorothy Hodgkin did win the Nobel Prize for revealing the structures of compounds, including penicillin and the vitamin B12. But yet when newspapers wrote about her, they always introduced her as a housewife and mother of three. And that tells us a lot how even successful women scientists were described and framed.
Definitely. Yeah, this is a challenge that reappears for lots of women, and the sort of the bind they were in, because a lot of them did depend on men in various ways to grant them opportunities, and often they worked as a pair. There's various examples of that. Also Masters and Johnson and their work on sexology, Anne McLaren, an embryologist, worked with Donald Mickey, a computer scientist. So there's a lot of these kind of dynamic duos of women working with men, but also, you know, realistically wouldn't have been granted access and opportunities had the men not been there. And at the same time, then when they did find some success or recognition, often that was overshadowed by their housewife status or their kind of these really feminized kind of stereotypes of, you know, very maternal women or beautiful women. So it's definitely a recurring theme. Also, Jane Goodall was a victim of that. She was widely, you know, her work in Tanzania was widely reported by the National Geographic, accompanied by these beautiful photographs, but often, you know, really emphasizing her long legs and blonde hair, for example.
Very often we see how crucial work is described as supporting work. So even though it's central to the scientific achievement, it kind of gets relegated to being only, you know, on the margins. And I'm thinking of what you described about Katherine Johnson's work about helping to put people into space, or Anne McLaren helping to make IVF possible. Crucial scientific work gets sidelined or marginalized.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it happens a lot. And I part of what I'm trying to do with this book is to really foreground the work that we don't conventionally talk about as part of this discovery narrative in science, you know, of individuals and their instant breakthroughs. A lot of the work in science is highly collaborative, involves a lot of communicating, a lot of organizing, a lot of disproving things as well as proving them. And a lot of women really in this book, often by necessity or because they were on the margins, really showcase how much scientists depend on networks and skills like communication in order to do what they do.
So talk to me about the present day. Do you think that we have reached a point now where we don't need to worry about such prejudice, such misogyny, the patriarchy? Or are there still challenges with making sure that the scientific breakthroughs and the scientific achievements are recognised, are acknowledged, and do receive the praise they deserve?
Yeah, I think there are still challenges. Obviously, women now have access to education, but a lot of fields, especially the STEM subjects, are still very male-dominated. So women often still struggle culturally in those fields with being heard or feeling comfortable, and asking the questions that, you know, that they see are important that might not be so central in the field. So I also talk about Timnit Gebru, who's an AI, a computer scientist working now, who worked for Google. And even her story really shows how she was in, you know, Silicon Valley in the sort of 2010s, in these fields that were really, you know, exciting, but all male-dominated spaces, and struggling to find her sort of allies and people asking the same questions as her. So I think it's still often an issue, and it's reflected in the statistics. So women are still very underrepresented in those fields, and that, you know, continues into the workplace, and also when we talk about, you know, more senior positions, there's fewer women at those higher ranking levels academically. So it's definitely an ongoing problem.
And the scientist you mentioned there, she was crucial in demonstrating serious racial and gender disparities in facial recognition systems, and questioning the environmental and social costs of these large language AI models.
Yeah, exactly. So she's really drawing attention to the very human questions underlying AI. We often focus on, you know, on the technology itself, but she really argues that the biggest challenges and risks when it comes to artificial intelligence are, you know, groupthink, insularity, and issues like environmental issues or racism, all of which are problems we are dealing with in the world much more widely.
Is there a favorite scientist that you have in the book, someone who you were proud to be able to retell their story or to bring it to a new audience?
I mean, I suppose I always have a special place in my heart for Anne McLaren. I wrote my PhD on her, and she's very underappreciated, I think. She was an IVF pioneer, really developed some of the techniques that were really crucial to IVF. But she's often not recognized because she didn't focus on a single breakthrough discovery. She really hopped between different fields. So she's a really good example of a scientist working in a very different way, really emphasizing communication and relationships and network building, and not getting her due credit because of it.
Sometimes great science and great activity means saying no, or saying to move more slowly, or challenging the idea that you have to always go at a high speed. Because Frances Oldham Kelsey, she said no at a crucial time when she was requested to approve thalidomide, and that prevented a catastrophe in the United States.
Yeah, exactly. So Frances Kelsey was working for the FDA in the US in the 1960s. And thalidomide was originally a sleeping medication that had already been introduced throughout Europe, Australia, Canada, and babies were being born with birth defects. And Frances was in charge of reviewing new drug applications at the FDA, and she refused to accept this one for thalidomide there. And she had a real hard time trying to kind of oppose the very pushy pharmaceutical reps who really wanted to get this medication to market. So she showed how much just rigor and precision and just a kind of cautiousness are really crucial to science as much as the sort of entrepreneurial risk-taking that we often celebrate when it comes to scientific discoveries.
Well, it's a brilliant new book. It's called A History of Science in 21 Women. It's published in hardback by One World Publications. The author is Marika Big. And Marika, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.
We'll be back with more Talking History on News Talk right after this. Welcome back. We're Talking History. Bookshops are a comforting sight on our high streets. They may feel timeless, yet their history is a restless and turbulent one, filled with as many entrepreneurial street hawkers and illicit trades as with beloved institutions. And a new book explores the evolution of bookselling, from the cramped collector shops frequented by Samuel Pepys in the 17th century to the radical feminist bookshops of the 1970s, the rise of monolithic chains, and the new world of online selling. Connecting stories and lives that span centuries, countries, and continents, the book brings us into the beloved bookshops of today and looks forward to the possible experiences of booksellers tomorrow. The book is called The Bookshop, A History of Bookselling from the Dawn of Print to the 21st Century, published by Profile Books in hardback. The author is Andrew Pettigrew. Well, Andrew, you're very welcome to the show. And can I begin maybe at the end of the book with your chapter Apocalypse Not Yet? Because people have been predicting the destruction, the decline, the obsolescence of the bookstore for many years, and large online chains and large in store chains seem to have posed all of these threats, and yet the bookshop is still thriving.
Yes, indeed. But I have to say, this is a recurring trope from the late 19th century onwards. I've just read a very interesting book about the history of the bicycle. And in the 1880s and 1890s, people were saying that the bicycle would kill reading, because precisely the sort of people who could afford bicycles were the ones who read books. So, and then this only lasted for about 10 years. Then people started blaming the car and the radio and the cinema and the television. And yet the book winds on regardless. I think this is just a major error in people's understanding of the history of technology. By and large, when a new technology comes along, humans are sophisticated enough to just incorporate that into the web of media that they use. And so they take what they like about the new without discarding what they value in the old. There's no evidence worldwide, actually, that book production is going backwards. And for every local bookshop which closes in the United Kingdom, certainly, there's one that's opening. So there's still a place for the independents. Here in St. Andrews, we have a splendid independent bookshop, which offers us something like 70,000 titles to choose from. I think that's where the chains do come in, because they're often very large. And it's not impossible that people could have a particular affection for their local branch of Waterstones. The fact that it's a chain doesn't mean it's not of utility to readers.
You begin the book with a wonderful prologue where you go shopping with Samuel Pepys. If we were to follow Mr. Pepys into a bookshop in the 17th century, how different would the experience be from walking into one today?
Oh, it would be completely different, and we wouldn't necessarily be welcome unless we were of the same social class as Pepys then. By this point, a senior official in the English government. But so much would be different. Today we expect a range of hardbacks and paperbacks, and this simply wasn't the case then. We'd expect browsing, whereas these shops were, generally speaking, tiny. And when Pepys went in, there would only be one chair there for a honored client. So you wouldn't find lots of people there. Not everybody would be welcome, as I would say. Today, when we go into a bookshop and buy something, we normally pay for it. in those days, most of the people who used bookshops would not be carrying cash around. They'd send their servants round, you know, every 3 months to pay for the books they'd had. There would be no window display, which is so important these days. There would be very little fiction. We have expect a mix of fiction and non-fiction today, but for the most part, 17th century bookshops would be selling theology, medicine, law, history, classics, the works of the Roman and Greek classics. So it was a much narrower clientele they were looking at, which is why so much selling of books went on not in bookshops, but outdoors.
And that's incredible, because we're used to, you know, big farmers markets and other types of markets today. But, you know, sometimes books are sold, but it's not in the way that you describe in the book, and that it would be quite an incredible sight, I think, to see these huge spaces and all the books that you could buy.
Yeah. You see, in the late 19th century and the 20th century, the profession of bookselling reorganized itself into really separate silos: new books, secondhand books, and antiquarian books. And that's what we grew up with before digital came along. And yet this was relatively recent. All bookshops would sell a mixture of new and secondhand books. They would often be the collections of collectors who were deceased, and these books would flow back into the bookshops. And to be honest, in those days, a client didn't really mind that much whether they were getting a new book or one which was secondhand. The other thing to bear in mind is the paper quality in those days was so good that these books do last through the centuries extremely well, which is, of course, why we know so much about the early years of the book trade 500 years ago.
It's also a story of revolutions, because there are all these different breakthroughs in different centuries that really transform how books are sold. And, you know, we can talk about Gutenberg and the printing press, but we can also talk about technological advances in the 19th century that really changed even how books were designed and created and sold then in the 19th century.
Yeah, the 19th century was absolutely vital for the development of the mass market. Until this point, although literacy improved progressively, back in the 14th, 15th century, it was very much associated with need. That is, people who needed to be able to read for their profession, for their trade. And that meant that it was also very gendered. There was a great gap in literacy between men and women, though this began to close in the 17th century Dutch Republic, where a lot of businesses were run by women. And of course, the Reformation helped with its stress on education. But you're quite right to say that it only really begins to have a large audience of readers in the 18th century, the great century when novels became part of the offer, but in the 19th century particularly, with the advent of the railways, telegrams, which improved the newspapers' offering, because you could now learn the news much more rapidly. The steam press was very important too, because that meant you could run off many, many more copies, and lithotype, which meant you no longer had to rely on compositors composing print one character at a time, which, once you've got a mass readership and have to have big editions of newspapers, books, magazines, that sort of problem becomes a real bottleneck.
So talk to me then about the invention of the paper back then in the 20th century and the revolution that occurred with that, because that really again transformed the quantity as well as the price and the cost of these books.
Mm. The paperback has a strange intermittent history until the 20th century. A lot of pamphlets in the 16th and 17th century were sold unbound and often remain unbound, you know, thin little things. And then you get, in the 19th century, you get penny bloods and dime books in America. These are the sort of books you'd pick up as a newspaper stall rather than in a bookshop. And so the revolution of the 20th century is putting into paper quality literature. And that was what Alan Lane was all about in Penguins. It was not just the sort of slightly disreputable literature that circulated among children and youths and adolescents, and I have to say was still circulating in my school in the 1970s. But Penguin really was revolutionary in that it was offering quality literature, fiction and nonfiction, for sixpence a book. Now, the hardback equivalent of that book would be about 7 shillings and 6pence. That is the equivalent of 15 Penguin books. So you could see why people went for them. It also helped that Penguin was started 3 or 4 years before the Second World War. And that, of course, was a time when lots of people were looking for reading matter, at a time also, actually, where production went down massively because of paper shortages. So it was a real revolution, and it not only in the people who could read it, but the way in which it changed public libraries. Up to this stage, public libraries were intent on improving people who went through its doors. But now, with the paperback revolution, they started stocking the sort of Wild West novels, crime novels, romances, which they thought was a bit beneath them in the 1920s and 30s. Because if they wanted to keep their doors open, public libraries had to offer the sort of things people wanted, because they could get these cheap books so very easily.
What about new technologies and e-readers and the Kindle revolution? Is that something that fills you with concern, or do you just see it as the latest iteration in these technological advances and changes?
I've never been much bothered about it because, you know, one of the earlier books I wrote was about the transition to print from manuscripts. But of course, this didn't end manuscript culture. When I was going to the United States in young adulthood, I still had to fill a form manually. I mean, the use of the manuscript has never really died out. And this is true with every innovation since. I mean, people could listen to the radio and still read books. And actually, the book industry was quite flexible and at dealing with these new things. So the book would be integrated into what the radio had to offer with book programs and drama and plays. Likewise, there was a very close relationship between films and books, and then again, television and books. So I think the great thing about the book is that it was a very good invention in the first place. And people, although they may have an e-reader, particularly for holidays, people still like the tactile quality of books. And reading books on screen, if you're trying to get through, let's say, a text of 120,000 words, that's actually very difficult to do on screen. People tend to use screen reading for short stories or articles and this sort of thing. And that's possible, but you wouldn't want to read War and Peace on screen. And so the market can be carved up quite happily. The e-reader seems to me to have been plateaued now. And the idea that it would destroy the physical book was never something that I believed in, and I think it hasn't happened. One of the great things about technology is that all technological innovations, like, let's say, the internet, are surrounded by false prophecy. People have to come up with what will happen. And we're going through this about with AI now, but many of the consequences are never imagined. But there it is. It tends to be the case that the people who assure you that this invention will supersede all others are people who've invested heavily in making that come true.
Very good. When we think about bookshops and book selling, we think of the modern world and maybe the last 500 years. But actually, as your book shows, you can go back to ancient Greece and Rome and cities there where you had booksellers and market stalls, but it was very much an elite activity.
It was, yes. In those days, books were very expensive, and in the Mediterranean, they had a very difficult medium to put them on, and that this was papyrus, and you had papyrus scrolls. And the problem with this is that although in dry climates they're very useful, they really need for the text to be transferred every generation or so. Otherwise, they just sort of are very vulnerable to insects or degradation, and particularly to damp. So that wasn't a medium for the ages. And of course, each time you recopy a text, you risk making mistakes and changing it and this sort of thing. So when they moved on from the use of papyrus, which is a plant, to parchment, which is animal skins, then you got a much hardier medium to save text. But it was really the arrival from Asia of paper that made possible a much broader readership.
Your book also reminds us how dangerous it could be to be selling books at different times in our history, and at the time of the Papal Index, when you had disruptions to the trade and censorship and people being executed for importing forbidden books.
Yeah, it was. I think it's from the beginning of print, rulers realized that this was a potential danger to their authority. So every country, state, or city in Europe has its own censorship regime. But I think the people most at risk with censorship are printers, that is, the people who produced it, and authors, because if something had been said which the authorities objected to, then it was most likely the author they'd like to get. And when you think of it, this is one area in which booksellers suffered less, because if you think of it, if you send an official around to your shop, the likelihood is that someone will have tipped you off before they arrive, so you can put away or hide any suspect material. Now, much of what was suspect tended to be pamphlets, and so you could probably just slip them into a bigger book. And they wouldn't be found. So, in fact, the number of booksellers who actually suffered was small. There are cases, particularly when there's religious warfare going on, where anyone from the other side is vulnerable. And people would know in, say, Catholic France that so-and-so was a Protestant bookseller. But on the whole, booksellers got off quite lightly when it came to censorship.
What impact did circulating libraries have on bookstores? Because in one sense, you might think it would have damaged the bookstores because it would have created a way of borrowing a book without having to buy it. But yet, by making novels and books more accessible, they often and sometimes helped the bookstores.
Yes. I mean, because we're talking in the 16th and 17th century with a very limited market, you know, people who had inherited money or the professions, which in those days meant clergy, lawyers, or doctors, they needed books. But because it was relatively elite, there wasn't much of an incentive to drive the prices of new books down. And this remained the case in the first century of the novel, which is about from 1750 to 1850. And lots of people wanted to read these. By this time, there was a very large female audience for reading as well. So the fact that the publishers kept the prices of these new books, like Jane Austen's, artificially high was a real problem. And this is where circulating libraries came in. Something as much as 50% of the total run of a novel would be snapped up by circulating libraries. And these were places where you would either pay an annual subscription or you would go in on a daily basis and just pick up a book for sixpence and taking it away to read it. And actually, this was one of the great periods of the expansion of the bookselling network. And about half the 1,000-plus circulating libraries we know of in Britain and Ireland, 50% of them were attached to bookshops. And so they simultaneously sold books and rented them out. And where accounts have survived of these, we see that actually it's very much the same people who come in to read. Sometimes, rather than paying for a book, they think, well, I'll try it out in the circulating library. And if I like it, perhaps I'll buy it after that. So it was an interesting age when you are simultaneously selling books and renting them. But this seems to have worked.
Well, it's a brilliant book. And I share your optimism at the end of the book about the future of books and bookshops.
Well, I'm glad you do. Yeah.
Well, it's a wonderful new book. It's called The Bookshop, A History of Bookselling from the Dawn of Print to the 21st Century. It's published in hardback by Profile Books. The author is Andrew Pettigrew. And Andrew, thank you so much for joining us tonight.
Great pleasure.
And that does bring us to the end of another edition of Talking History. My thanks to my special producer tonight, Micheál O'Connell, my series producer, Mairéis O'Sullivan. We've got more debate and discussion next week, so hope you can join us then. We've been Talking History. Good night.